Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. My guest today wrote one of the most beguiling stories ever told. I'm talking of the novel Chocolat, which became a successful movie starring Juliette Binoche and Johnny Depp. Award-winning best-selling author Joanne Harris has written six additional novels, a collection of short stories, and has co-authored two cookbooks. Coming up in the next hour, we'll talk about Rune Marks, Joanne's latest book, which is an epic adventure based on other worlds and the rune magic of the Nordic gods. It's been described as a fast-paced, funny descent into the underworld tale of secrets, revenge, trust, and destiny. And it's about the end of all things and the possibility for new beginnings. We'll also talk about The Lollipop Shoes, the sequel to Chocolat, Joanne's career as a writer, and why priest baiting is listed as one of her hobbies in Who's Who. Joanne Harris, welcome to the show.
Hello there. It's very nice to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here. And I have to say, I love the title, The Lollipop Shoes. I can't wait to find out more about that.
Well, I'm glad you like it because it's not going to be the title in America.
Oh!
In America, it's going to be called The Girl with No Shadow.
Oh!
But, you know, these things happen in publishing.
They do.
They like to wrong foot us.
That's right. In fact, I watched a movie yesterday that had a whole different title in England, but that's a whole other thing.
Well, it does. It happens all the time.
Yeah. So I want to go back, way back before your success. You studied modern and medieval languages at St. Catherine's College, Cambridge. You were a teacher. Tell us how you got into writing, how you started writing, Joanne.
Oh, well, I was writing ever since I was very young. I enjoyed it. I never thought it was going to be a career. When I eventually did get a career as a teacher, I kept enjoying it and kept doing it half in secret, and I kind of muddled my way into print somehow. It was definitely not a kind of career move. It was very much an accident.
And you were actually, was Chocolat your third book? Or
no, it was my third, but it was the first one that got the kind of attention that meant that I was able to give up teaching and actually try doing it full time.
Mm-hmm. And you were born of a French mother, English father. How did that influence you? I'm sure it had a big influence on you, knowing that you grew up in Yorkshire and probably wasn't very common at that time.
No, it wasn't very common. And I think culturally it gives you a slightly different perspective because obviously you are part of two cultures, but you don't belong entirely to both. And I think it gives you a kind of rather broader sense of what people are like. Also, it made me into a linguist, of course, because English isn't my first language. And I think that the fact that I learned English somewhat later when I was about 6 or 7.
Oh, really?
That, you know, my written style in English is slightly different, perhaps a bit idiosyncratic.
Mm. That's interesting. So even though your father was English, you didn't speak English at home?
No, because my mother didn't really speak very good English. And my father's French is fabulous. In fact, he's a wonderful linguist anyway. And so we decided, or rather it was unilaterally decided by my mother, that we would be a little French enclave in Yorkshire. And until I went to school, that's what it was.
Now, I'm guessing that made you a little different from the other kids at school.
Oh, yes. I was definitely considered a bit peculiar.
but I can see how that might translate into some of the work that you've done. Where you have these different characters who go out into the world regardless and just say, you know, this is who I am.
Well, quite. I think it does help if you're a little peculiar and you've got that slightly outside perspective. I think it does help if you're going to go into storytelling, because actually the really good stories are always started by somebody who is trouble or who doesn't fit in some way.
That's very true. Now, you've always written for the adult market until now. Your latest book, Rune Marks, is categorized as a children's market, young adult market, and I know you don't like categorization.
I'm not terribly pleased with it. I think that it's a little restrictive. I think it's partly the subject matter that has prompted my publishers to do this, because, you know, I don't really make the distinction between something that kids are allowed to read and something that adults should read or not. I haven't really compromised my style on this, and so I find that I get a very interesting mix of readers, particularly with this book.
I suspect you're going to get a lot of adult readers.
Well, in England, I already have. I think, you know, the whole fantasy market, I think if you are somebody who fantasy appeals to, it's not something that you're just going to grow out of.
Right. Well, it's great escapism.
It is, and it's great to write, too.
Yes, I'm sure.
It's such fun to write, and it's nice, given that I've written about magic before in some contexts, but it's nice to actually be able to go full-out fantasy here and have unashamed fantasy elements in this plot.
Yeah. So tell me what drew you to this book? What drew you to writing this book aimed for children, or as the publisher has categorized it, for children?
Well, I had a child at the time who was 9, and it struck me that none of my books were likely to appeal to her. And so I started to write her this bedtime story, which grew and grew and became a book. And it was entirely a surprise to me, actually. I hadn't intended it to be for public consumption, but it was such fun, and it got to be so long and so complicated that eventually, well, here it is.
Right. Now, the book Runemux is set in a universe of 9 worlds, not unlike that of Norse legend.
Yes, very similar.
So go ahead and tell us, without giving the good bits away, go ahead and tell us give us a synopsis of the book, the story.
Well, it carries on from Norse legends, which rather depressingly end with the end of the world. Ragnarok, this final great battle where the gods are supposed to be wiped out and the world comes to an end. 500 years later, Ragnarok has been and gone. The gods are not all dead, some are defeated, and they are scattered all over the 9 worlds. And a new religion has taken the stage, something which is a little bit like the crusading early Christianity, the purpose of which is to wipe out all remnants of the old times, supernatural beings, gods, stories, even dreams are now to be outlawed, because you never know. If you have a dream, you might get ideas, you might rebel. And into this world is born this girl called Maddie, who has a rune mark, a sign of the old magic on her hand. And she is going to be caught between this big battle which is brewing between old gods and new.
Okay, sounds good. And you say that the main character is based on a mix of you and your daughter. How so?
Well, I was writing this kind of story at a very early age. I was reading Norse mythology at a very early age, and I think kids usually do write about themselves, and it was a place I found quite familiar to revisit, and because I was writing for my daughter, it became a sort of compound character between her and me, but we are quite alike in many ways.
Mm. Now, you say you based the book on Norse mythology, but created your own version of rune marks you've got the Elder script in your book. How did you change the rune marks that we know, that we would know in America? How did you change those, and why did you change them to fit the story?
Well, I didn't really change them as such. The ones that you know in America tend to be early English in origin, but runic systems were around all over Europe. And what I decided to do was to use the 16-letter Icelandic runic system, which is perhaps slightly less well-known. It's almost the same, but obviously some runes are slightly different. Some of them are reversed, because I wanted to start with a 16-letter alphabet, and then to expand it later as new runes are acquired. But the runes are all authentic. I haven't invented them, and I haven't reinterpreted them. Basically, if anything, I have just retranslated some of the runic poems that come with them and put a certain level of interpretation on that. But it's all pretty solid reality here, and the language that I'm using is not invented here. The language of chaos is basically old Icelandic.
Right. You have the worlds of inland or chaos, and you say that's mostly old Icelandic language. You didn't want to make up your language. You're not good at it.
I don't think that I need to make up languages, particularly when there's already something in place, something which is very authentic. And I think the language actually gives such a lot of insight into the culture that it seems a pity to bypass that. And there were so many interesting words in that language which gave you so many ideas about how runes were perceived, how magic was perceived, how that rather primitive and brutal culture developed.
Right, and I can say, just from putting the research together for the show, today's show, that I could have got really sidetracked, I could have got taken off on a big tangent, because it's so interesting when you start looking at all the history behind it and how all the elements came together.
Yes, it's an enormous topic, and it's one that I've been interested in for such a long time. So all I needed to do really with this book was to cherry pick some of the things that I already knew and some of the reading that I'd already done to expand it in this sort of fantasy setting and to make it fun and to try to access some of the genuine humor that those legends contain.
Mm. Tell us a little bit about the Nine Worlds, if you would.
Well, the Norse people believed that the universe was structured fundamentally differently to the way we understand it now, that basically there were nine worlds suspended in and around the branches of a giant tree called Yggdrasil. And so there was, at the top, there was Asgard, which was the citadel of the gods. And then there was Midgard, the middle world, which was the world of men. And they were linked by the rainbow, which was the bridge between the gods and the men. And then underground, there was the world below, which was the place where goblins and trolls and underground supernatural entities were.
Mm.
It was all ringed by the ocean, at which point after that there was Outlands, which were the domains of giants, frost giants on one side and fire giants on the other. Below the world below, there is Hell, which is the place of the dead. And then there is, underneath Hell, there is the Netherworld, which is a place of damnation. And beyond that, there is chaos. And everything is linked by dream, which is, in this book, really quite an important strand, because it is through dreams that people access magic and the world of the imagination. And of course, that is what the Order is about to outlaw.
Right. And they're about the... You actually start that off. Do you have the book with you right now?
I do indeed.
Why don't you go ahead and read that page you're going to read? Because that kind of explains a little bit about the dream and chaos and how it all links together.
Okay, I will. I'll read you a little bit from the beginning of the book, which just explains the world and my main character.
Sounds good.
7 o'clock on a Monday morning, 500 years after the end of the world, and goblins had been at the cellar again. Mrs. Scattergood, the landlady at the Seven Sleepers Inn, swore it was rats, but Maddie Smith knew better. Only goblins could have burrowed into the brick-lined floor, and besides, as far as she knew, rats didn't drink ale. But she also knew that in the village of Morbury, as in the whole of the Strond Valley, certain things were never discussed, and that included anything curious, uncanny, or unnatural in any way. To be imaginative was considered almost as bad as giving oneself airs, and even dreams were hated and feared, for it was through dreams, or so the good book said, that the seer folk had crossed over from chaos, and it was in dream that the power of the fairy remained, awaiting its chance to re-enter the world. And so the folk of Morbury made every effort never to dream. They slept on boards instead of mattresses, avoided heavy evening meals, and as for telling bedtime tales, well... The children of Morbury were far more likely to hear about the martyrdom of St. Sepulchre or the latest cleansings from World's End than tales of magic or of world below. Which is not to say that magic didn't happen. In fact, over the past 14 years, the village of Morbury had witnessed more magic in one way or another than any place in the Middle World. That was Maddie's fault, of course. Maddie Smith was a dreamer, a teller of tales, and worse. And as such, she was used to being blamed for anything irregular that happened in the village. And if she protested, folk would say that she'd always had a troublesome nature, that their ill luck had begun the day she was born, and that no good would ever come of a child with a ruin mark, that rusty sign on the Smith girl's hand, which some oldsters called the witch's ruin, and which no amount of scrubbing would remove.
Very good. It really draws you in. I got sucked right in when I was reading this. So I can't see a lot of adults reading it. I found out you used to write comic strips, and the book you say is a descendant of those comic strips.
Well, as a child, I did a lot of comic strips. I did a lot of illustrated stories in one way or another, and I spent most of my formative years not listening to subjects like maths and Latin and physics and actually doing these drawings. These rather complicated drawings under my desk lid, which is, you know, partly where some of this book came from.
Right, right. I'd like to know more about Norse mythology. I think it's quite fascinating. And the Norse gods are typically very different to the Egyptian and Greek gods, aren't they? They're less ethereal, they're more human.
They're very much more human. They're much more accessible, and they have very distinct, very strong human personalities, including human flaws. They're frequently wrong, misled, stupid, malicious. They betray each other all the time. you know, these are gods who, in spite of their phenomenal powers, get things wrong all the time, which is really quite refreshing for a child listening to these stories.
Mm.
And very much of their mythology is based on infighting, backbiting, and generally just not being very lofty or godlike at all.
And your gods in the book have human frailties. You gave them human frailties too.
Very much, yes.
Very much
I tried
in line.
To mirror that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to take a break, Joanne. When we come back, I'd like to talk to you about your career as a writer. And I want to find out more about some of those intriguing hobbies that you have listed in Who's Who. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest today is Joanne Harris. She's the author of Rune Marks. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Join Vicky St. Clair and MSNBC's Bob Sullivan to learn how to save money and avoid the everyday hidden fees applied by big business. Tune in Monday, January 21st at noon for Gotcha Capitalism on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. For more information, see conversationslive.net.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show at its new time, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Hi, this is Howard Bono.
And I'm Gary Manns.
And we are the co-hosts for The Money Thing. Gary, we're moving times, aren't we?
January 8th, that's Tuesday, January 8th at noon, right after the Dr. Pat Show. The Money Thing with Howard Bono and Gary Manns is coming your way. Brand new time for a brand new year.
Can't wait. That's Tuesdays at noon right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 KKNW.
Spread the word. You don't have to settle for the usual talk radio. Now there's Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for being with us today. We have Joanne Harris with us. She's the author of Rune Marks. Her book has been described as a fast-paced, funny descent into the underworld tale of secrets, revenge, trust, and destiny. It's about the end of all things and the possibility for new beginnings. And I mentioned earlier, Joanne, that you have a really intriguing list of hobbies in Who's Who, and I want to just share some of those with our listeners. they're described as mooching, lounging, strutting, strumming, priest baiting, and quiet subversion of the system. Although she also enjoys, and I can never say this word, obfuscation, sleaze, rebellion, witchcraft, armed robbery, tea, and biscuits. So tell us about this.
Well, you have to understand that in England, Who's Who is considered a very serious matter. And I tried very hard to have a very serious entry, but for some reason, it just didn't quite work out that way.
You didn't want to be categorized, right?
No, I don't like to be categorized. And also, you know, Who's Who is absolutely filled with people who enjoy polo and flower arranging. And I thought that, you know, if I was going to tell some lies, they may as well be colorful ones.
Mm. Well, one of the hobbies that you've listed there is priest baiting. And you've written more than once about the conflict between magic and religion. And
well, some of the lies are true. In fact, especially the lies.
Okay. So what do you have to say about magic and religion and where it fits in together?
Well, I've written about religions generally before in some of my other books. In Rune Marks, I do more or less the same in a slightly different context. But The thing that links them all, really, is the idea of a slightly subversive and usually female character at loggerheads with a large, faceless, intolerant bureaucratic system, which may or may not be religious in origin. Usually, in my books, it has been the Catholic Church, but it could quite easily have been something else. Basically, it's about people who use their ideology, be they religious or political or whatever, to establish their own agenda of control. And usually I find that the church is really quite understanding about this. I get a lot of fan mail from young priests, and I'm starting to collect bishop fan mail as well, so the great thing now would be for the Pope to send me a letter, and I'd be completely vindicated.
Did you send him a book?
No, not yet. Maybe I should send him rune marks.
There you go. You should send him rune marks. You might like it. I know you're not going to like it, but the book is going to get compared to Harry Potter because of the magic and, you know, the fantasy world. And that has, especially in the Midwest out here, hit a very brick wall, big brick wall with the Bible Belt. In fact, I watched a documentary just 2 weeks ago about this, and I was shocked to hear a preacher talking to these young kids at Bible camp about the evils of Harry Potter. How are you going to handle that kind of situation if you run into that?
I doubt I shall handle it at all. I doubt I shall run into it, really. Mm. People will either read the book or they won't. I mean, I think that there isn't really any arguing with people who believe that even to tell stories is somehow wrong. In fact, I do think there may be some people in rune marks just like it. If anyone recognizes themselves in this way, I don't think I'll be able to talk them round. You know, I think right. I've kind of lost that one.
Right. Okay, so you're not even going to go there.
Well, no, I mean, the thing is, I don't think there is any arguing with deeply held religious beliefs. However, in my view, erroneous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just tell stories. That's all I do. I challenge anybody to prove that I've done otherwise.
Right.
And I think that stories should be subversive. And if stories do raise a few hackles from time to time, then I think the writer should take that as a compliment. Because the worst thing is just to leave people indifferent, I think. And
that's such a good
point. If stories
can
make you smile or laugh or get angry or be afraid, then basically that is magic. It's pure voodoo, and it's what we like. It's what we do.
That's such a good point. And if you look at some of the stories told over the centuries, some of the most controversial stories are the ones that we're still hearing today. So there's no harm in telling them. Comedian and writer Steve Martin says that writing is easy, all you sit down and write. On the other end of the spectrum, the late gonzo journalist Hunter Thompson said writing is hell, and he described it as the flip side of sex. It's good only when it's over. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
I enjoy writing. You know, I think I meet so many people who feel that writing is in some way bleeding onto the page, and I just wonder, why do they do it? There are just so much easier ways to make a living. I've always just enjoyed writing, even when it's tough and even when you have to go to sort of difficult emotional places. I've always thought it was great. It's not always easy. But, you know, I think it's something that gives me enormous pleasure. And even if I hadn't been published, I would be writing anyway. I always would have done.
Mm. I read somewhere, I can't just put my fingers on it right now, but I read somewhere that you... if your publisher were to put you under pressure, you wouldn't like that at all. And if you weren't writing what you enjoy, you would just go back to teaching.
Well, I was good at teaching. I enjoyed it. And it was a proper job, of course. Mm-hmm. Whereas writing, as my mother still reminds me on a frequent basis, is not. And, you know, why would I do it if I didn't love doing it and I didn't want to keep doing it? But no, I don't like to write under pressure. I don't like to be reminded that a book is, to many people, just a product to be sold. I don't like to be marked, labeled, and numbered.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like to be told what to do. I'm afraid it makes me sound rather a troublemaker, but maybe that's one of the good things about being in my position.
Yeah, you should have listed that in Who's Here. But I think we got that impression from those things there anyway, which were great.
No, I think my publishers are actually very understanding about me. They understand that I have circumstances in which I work best. And obviously, we all want me to be in those circumstances. They know that I love to write and that I write fast. And that giving me an impossible deadline is not going to make me write any faster. It will just make me ratty.
Right.
And they also know that I'm not disciplined enough to write something that that is writing on demand, and that it probably wouldn't be any good if I did write it. So you know, I think they've been very good, and I think I've got an extremely good public. I've got a hugely supportive and understanding public who have followed me to all these different places, and I've written short stories and cookbooks and murder mysteries, and now there's this all-out fantasy novel. And, you know, I've got such a good core of constant readers who have just made it very clear that all they want is the next thing. They don't want to determine what it's going to be at all. Mm. They just want a story.
Right. I read that you said one of your gripes is feeling that some people feel there's a right approach and a wrong approach to telling stories. And that you just say stories are stories and there's nothing wrong with writing fiction.
No, there's nothing wrong with writing fiction at all. I think people need stories as much as they ever did. I think the fact that so many adults are reading kids' books proves that there's obviously a feeling that in some adult fiction, some of these books are not quite plot-led enough for people, and they don't feel as if they are getting their money's worth in terms of just escapism. Mm. I think people have always loved stories, and people feel that stories give them hope. You know, even from fairy tales and myths and legends and the things I was brought up on, there is this idea that people need to feel that there can be a happy ending and that love can save you and that monsters can be overcome. And I don't think we've evolved all that much beyond that.
Right, right. You've also said that you don't believe that people have just one story in their lives, and you think that most people's lives are a succession of different stories. And I'm in particular thinking of the sequel to Chocolat, The Lollipop Shoes. I forget what you said it was going to be called here already. But
over here it's going to be called The Girl with No Shadow.
The Girl with
No Shadow. I like to work on the understanding that most lives are not just a single story and then there's a happy ever after. Then there will be a whole chain of stories. And obviously, they get more and more complex and more interesting.
Mm.
And so Girl with No Shadow is not Chocolat 2 in any way. It's very much a kind of a follow-up, not from just Chocolat, but from all the other things I've written since.
Mm. And it stands alone by itself. It's already been released, I believe, in England. Is that correct?
Yes, it'll have been out for nearly a year by the time it hits the shelves in America.
Oh, gosh. When is it coming out here, then?
In April.
In April. Okay, so we have that to look forward to. I also read that you, and I can understand this from looking at the books that you've written, that there are two factions of people. Some believe that everything you write is similar and it has a similar theme. But others believe that none of your books have anything in common. So
I love it when people disagree. It's wonderful.
And why do they have to even evaluate? I don't know. But what's your take on that?
I think that you bring to a novel what you can. And depending on your ability to see on different levels or to find different things in there, you will find more or less reward from the book. Very clearly, all my books have got one thing in common. They're all written by me. And clearly, you know, I've got certain preoccupations that follow me throughout my books. Usually the plots are quite different, but there are a number of kind of recurring themes and recurring types of character because I like to write about certain types of people. And I find certain types of people interesting. And, you know, why would I write about people that I thought were dull?
Mm-hmm.
You know, also, my preoccupations in certain areas are not going to cease just because I finished a book. And so sometimes something can evolve and I can take it a little further. So I wrote three books that were metaphorically at least centered around food. And I took three different aspects of food and explored them. So in Chocolat, I took the positive, tolerant, loving aspects of food. And then in Blackberry Wine, I took the idea of food as nostalgia. And then in Five Quarters of the Orange, I had the idea of the negativity of food and the idea of food as a symbol for discord within the family. Now, you know, those three books are all nominally speaking about food, but they are very different books.
Mm.
I think it depends very much on the reader.
Yeah. And for people who haven't read all of your books yet, what kind of people do you find interesting? What kind of people are we going to see in your books?
Well, actually, I find pretty much everybody interesting. The more I travel and the more people I meet and the more people I talk to, the more I realize that even the people who start a conversation with, oh, I'm the dullest person in the world, they all have something interesting in their past. And sometimes they're not even aware how interesting they are because obviously everybody thinks that everyone else's world is much more important and interesting than theirs. But no, I like to write about people who don't quite fit. I like to write about eccentrics and obsessives and people whose lives are dominated by their passions. I don't particularly enjoy writing about people who conform and who are static, because obviously that doesn't make for good drama. I quite like writing about mature and elderly people, because I find that obviously they have a lot more stories in their history. I like to write about damaged people too, to a certain extent, because I like to explore the nature of damage and villainy, if you like. I've always said that I've got a soft spot for the villains that I write, because I enjoy looking at why people make the choices that they make and what those repercussions are.
Interesting. Terry Brooks, I talked with him several years ago, not on radio, but for an article I was writing, and he said that he auditions his characters as if they were auditioning for a movie. He brings them out in his head, auditions them. If they're not quite right for that particular book, he'll put them away. How do you create and develop your characters?
Gosh, that sounds very organized.
I think it does, doesn't it?
My characters, it's almost like method acting. Because I write in the first person most of the time, I feel that on some level I have to inhabit these characters. And so a lot of it is method acting, and I'll access parts of me and things that I've encountered, and I will try to make characters from that. Or sometimes I will lift characteristics from somebody I know. It's a little bit like putting on a play, you know. You borrow things from the people around you. So very often the child characters that I write are in some way quite similar to my daughter. I have borrowed from the experiences and the personalities of various members in my family. And, of course, a lot of the kind of emotional grounding tends to come from me, because I wouldn't have written about motherhood before being a mother. There are certain things that I feel more confident writing about because I've experienced them, regardless of whether what I'm writing is fiction or not.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds a very organic approach for you. I'm guessing, I don't know, but J.K. Rowling, for example, she's talked many times about how she plots out every single little thing.
Yes, she does.
And is that for you, or you take a more organic, come-as-it-feels kind of approach?
I don't tend to plot things out. Mm-hmm. I think the interesting thing about writers is that we all have these completely divergent approaches, and yet the end product is always a book.
Yes.
And so I don't beat myself up over this. I used to worry that I didn't plan much ahead, and that basically a lot of what I write is invention at short notice. But no, that's the way I like to do it. I think the thing about Jo Rowling's books is that they're very plot driven, and so it makes sense that she would want to be certain of where her plot was going. My books tend to be greatly character-driven, which means that I like to follow what the character would do at any point, as opposed to try to make the character serve the plot, because I find that characters tend to lose their believability if they serve the plot too much.
Sure.
And so this makes for some funny twists and turns in my stories, but actually that's great, because I wouldn't necessarily like to know where the story was going all the time. I quite like having a measure of uncertainty there. And I also think that if I'm going to come out with an amazing plot twist somewhere, if on some level it surprises me, then chances are it will surprise the readership as well.
Right. And you're going on the journey at the same time. That's great.
Yeah.
And you said, and it's true, your books are very character-driven. They're also very atmospheric. Do you see, like some writers, do you see place as a character?
I think place is very often a character. I think in some cases it's the most important character, because people are formed by geography and the places that they consider to be home. And so I do think that the setting is very important. And also because I'm, in many ways, the way I perceive things is very sensual. It's very visual, but also I would like to have as many sense impressions as possible. I'd like to create some measure of reality so that people can open the book and really feel as if they're actually there. And to do that, I think it's important to have as much description and sounds and smells and tastes and physical impressions as possible to make that real.
Mm. You certainly captured those in this Runemarks book. Since your approach is so organic, Joanne, have you ever written yourself into a corner? Have you ever got to a place where you're like, hey, there's nowhere I can go with this.
Oh,
I need
my.
To start
I do it
over.
All the time.
So what
I
happens?
Do it all the time. I've never actually written myself to such a standstill that I wasn't able to get out, but I have written myself into some pretty tight corners. I mean, at the end of Rune Marks, I was having such a bad time because my daughter was waiting for the next installment, and I had all my heroes in the netherworld at the end of the world with 10,000 undead priests about to blast them out of existence. And I thought, oh my God, the world is going to end and everyone's going to die, and I actually don't know what to do. And I had to put the book down for about 3 months before I finally got a sense of how I was going to get them out of it. And in some ways it was hairy, but it actually upped the drama for all of us, and it was great fun.
All right, well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Joanne Harris. Her new book is called Rune Marks, and it's described as a fast-paced, funny descent into the underworld tale of secrets, revenge, trust, and destiny. And Joanne is going to be appearing in Seattle. Let me just grab the piece of paper here. She's going to be appearing in Seattle at Bellingham on January 18th at Village Books at 1 p.m., and in Seattle at Third Place Books at 6:30 p.m. And I'll give that information out again before the end of today's show. Stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We'll be right back.
Across Seattle, humans are vanishing, returning as newborn vampires. With the sun as her enemy, the moon her guiding light, Manali must battle the beast who tortured her. But first, she must face her own demons in Otherworld. Romantic Times magazine calls Gallinoran's best-selling Otherworld series vivid, sexy, and mesmerizing. Darkling by Yasmin Gallinoran, available at bookstores now. For more information, see gallinoran.com.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Write it down, shout it loud. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. Now, wasn't that fun?
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest today is author Joanne Harris. She's the best-selling author of Chocolat, and her new book is called Rune Marks, and she's currently touring across America. She's going to be up here January 18th, and I'll tell you more about that at the end of the show. And Joanne, I wonder if you'd read another section from the book for us.
Okay, well, this is somewhere in the middle of the book, and my heroine, Maddie, has had a number of adventures underground to retrieve an artifact called the Whisperer, which turns out to be an oracle, and it is now trying to talk her into awakening some mysterious people who've been sleeping underneath the ice, and for very good reason, for 500 years.
Okay.
Is there no other way? Said Maddie at last. Trust me, I'm an oracle. Once more, Maddie looked into the ice coffin where the pale woman lay, her colors shining softly in the cold light. The blue tones of the ice that encased her threw deathly shadows across her features, and her short hair, so light that it was almost lost in her frosty shroud, was frozen around her face like seaweed. Casting Piakan, Maddie narrowed her eyes, and the workings that bound the ice woman leaped into sight. As she had first seen, they resembled those that had held the Whisperer, but they were more numerous, binding the sleeper's ice coffin into a complex knot of interwoven glamour. Be careful, said the Whisperer. There may be traps set into the work. There were. Maddie could see them now, designed to spring out at anyone unwise enough to lay hands on the sleeper. A protective measure, but for whose protection? She touched the runes gently with her fingertips. At her touch, they glowed ice blue, and Maddie could feel them itching, working, struggling to be free. Think what they would tell you, Maddie, said the Whisperer in a silky voice. Secrets lost since the end of the world. Answers to questions you never dared ask, questions Odin would never have answered. It would be easy, Maddie knew. Beneath her fingertips, the runes were alive, quickening almost of their own accord. All they needed was a little help, and if, in exchange, they could give her the answers to questions that had plagued her all her life, who was she, really? What was her glam? And how did she fit into this tale of demons and gods? Quickly, before she could change her mind, Maddie gathered her strongest runes. She cast them, like knuckle bones, swift and sure. Cain, Tyr, Hagal, and finally Ur, the mighty ox, beneath which the block shattered with a sudden almighty crunch, and the blue surface of the ice was blasted in a second into a milky crackle glaze. The impact threw Maddie backward, one arm raised to shield her eyes from the ice shards that accompanied it. Then, when nothing else happened, she dropped her arm and moved carefully toward the now opaque block. Nothing moved. The trembling chandelier of ice above her head made small, shivery sounds in the aftershock of the blast, but no icicles fell, and a chilly silence came once more over the great hall. "Now what?" she said, turning to the whisperer. But before it could answer, there came a sound. First, a distant crunching sound, followed by a rumbling, a tumbling, a slip-sliding, and finally an avalanche of frozen material that fell from some distant funnel in the ceiling to thud against the glassy floor. Maddie moved fast, made for the wall of the cavern, and flattened herself against it, as now the balancing icicles began to drop from the vaulted ceiling, spike by spike, like the teeth of some giant threshing machine. A packet of snow the size of a hay wagon exploded against the ground close by, bringing down with it a jangling necklace of small projectiles, and lastly, a single, large object, no, a person, who landed heavily and with a muffled ouch on the fallen snow.
Very good. Do you like reading your own work?
Well, I've read so much of it. I read all of this book to my daughter Anushka as I was writing it. And,
wow.
Several times, in fact.
Over 500 pages long, too.
A lot of it, yes. But it did start off as a bedtime story, and it very much takes that kind of structure. Every chapter ends on a cliffhanger, and it was all very, very child-driven.
Right.
She had her favourite characters. She had her favourite situations. And the way the plot has evolved very much reflects that.
Yeah. How long did it take you to write this, Joanne?
Oh, it took me 4 years on and off because I was writing other books at the same time. So every time I found that with my other work something wasn't gelling or I had to give it some thinking time, I would go back to this and do a little more on it.
Writing can be somewhat isolating. Do you find it isolating or do you enjoy that part of it?
I wish I could be more isolated sometimes. I do an awful lot of travelling about. Mm. I think if I didn't, then I would be slightly concerned at the kind of solitary nature of writing. But as it happens, I need to have human stimulus. And I used to get this because I taught full-time and my life was full of weird people and unexpected encounters. And it still is, but I think that's the sort of thing I need. I'm very rarely closeted up in my house writing for any great length of time. There's always something going on.
Yeah. I also think that helps feed the creativity somewhat.
I think it does, particularly if you're interested in people. You have to get out there and talk to people.
Yeah, yeah.
And people have stories to tell and they're interesting and you get new ideas all the time. I mean, when I'm on tour like this, I write all the time because I feel quite energized by the kind of contact with different people and different places and different situations that I get here.
I know that you said that this is very child-driven and you told it to your daughter as a story, but from the actual writing perspective, was it different to write for a younger audience or not?
I didn't really think of it as writing for a younger audience. I have never talked down to my daughter, and I've never modified my vocabulary, so I didn't with this either. And I looked at it later on when I realized that it was going to be published, and I thought, oh, I bet they're going to get me to change some of these words, but actually they didn't, and I'm glad of this because I think, you know, a bright 8 or 9 year old, if they see a word they don't know, they'll just do what any adult does. They'll look it up.
Exactly, and that's how they learn. Because there is some education in here, and there's quite a bit of education in here.
Oh, well, don't tell the kids that. But no, it's true.
But in a fun way, in a really fun way. They'll learn without realizing.
I think, you know, I think it's a story and it's fun in many ways. But there are also lots of other things to find in there if you have the desire to do so. There's a lot of history and there's a lot of culture and there's an access to a culture which perhaps isn't all that familiar over here in the States.
Mm. as an author, what's the worst piece of career advice you've received, and what's the best piece?
The worst piece of career advice that was given to me was, being an author isn't a proper job. You need to stick to your proper job.
Mm-hmm.
The best piece of author advice, really, the best piece I've ever given or been given, is that nobody knows anything. if you want to write, then you should write. The world doesn't necessarily owe you a living, but I think the first stage in writing is that you have to enjoy what you're doing, because I don't believe that anyone who doesn't enjoy what they're doing is going to give enjoyment to anybody else.
For sure.
Besides which, when you do get rejected, as inevitably you will, and as I was for years, you will be able to sustain yourself by the fun that you get from your writing, and that will keep you going.
Right. I know that you use runes yourself. How do you use them?
Oh, well, I have used them in all sorts of different contexts. The usual context tends to be divination, in the way that people use tarot cards and I Ching coins and the rest. But, you know, I've been known to carve runes for luck on things, and my grandfather used to put runes to keep trespassers out of his garden so that they wouldn't steal his fruit. And my grandmother used to use them in all sorts of slightly mysterious ways. The nice thing about something simple and graphic like a rune is that actually there are so many different ways to use them that you can pretty much invent your own.
Mm.
Very clearly, the Scandinavian people had many, many different uses for runes that have been lost. And so anything you can think of is probably genuine.
Interesting. I actually have a rune around my neck. It's is it Rado? I can't remember the name of it.
That's right. It'll be Rado, the rune of travel.
Yeah,
life. And of not necessarily physical travel either, the travel of the mind.
Yes.
In rune marks, this is Odin's rune.
Yeah.
Because Odin, being a great traveler, and also a man who a god who traveled to the lands of the dead and all sorts of other places where the other gods didn't tend to go.
Mm. Interesting. It's a great book. I'm sure that you're going to get many adults reading this too.
Well, and why wouldn't they?
Exactly.
Think that, you know, imagination is something that cuts off when you hit 18.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about the Lollipop Shoes as I know it.
Okay.
And what we can expect from the upcoming sequel that's coming out. I think you said in April.
Yes. Well, this is called The Girl with No Shadow over here. And, again, I've got a little bit of a resistance to this word sequel, because it's come such a long time after Chocolat that inevitably I have changed, and so inevitably also my characters have changed. But it takes some of the characters from Chocolat, principally Vian and her daughter, and also her second daughter, who is just a suggestion at the end of Chocolat, but who is now 4 years old and has problems of her own. And life has treated Vian in a slightly different way to what you would expect. She has lost much of her confidence. She's made sacrifices for the sake of her children. And she has done a number of things that she didn't think she would do. She has moved away from the village in Chocolat. She has severed ties with most of her friends there. And she is now living in Paris, where she said she would never go, and trying her very best to be a regular person. So she has given up magic. In many ways, she's also given up making chocolate, and she's trying to be an ordinary citizen. This doesn't work, of course, because some people just can't be regular people. Anouk, her daughter, who is now just a preteen, is having difficulty settling as well, because she has a kind of divided sense of her mother's identity and her own place in the society she inhabits. And Rosette, the little girl, has behavioral problems, and they are basically slightly in a mess. And into this comes this character, this fabulous villain called Zosie de l'Alba, who is everything that Vian Rocher used to be. She is beautiful, she's flamboyant, she's magical, she's not afraid of using magic. But as the book continues, we realize that she's rather more Cruella de Vil than she is Mary Poppins, because outside she seems to be this wonderful free spirit, but inside she has a really quite sinister agenda of her own. And so it's going to be basically a showdown between two witches.
Interesting.
Set in Montmartre in Paris, with the stakes upped considerably from Chocolat, which was basically a much more comfortable little story. This is quite a disquieting story, not about what makes you happy, but principally about what makes you afraid.
Mm. I read somewhere that you said, as we get older, we all get more bitter and darker. Is that a reflection of the times?
It's possibly true. Also, perhaps as we lose our innocence, we realize that so many things are possible that we never thought were. Besides, I'm at my best when I'm writing dark stories, and all my stories have got some sort of slightly dark element. Even the ones that I consider to be the lightest and the brightest. This one's definitely in the kind of winter spectrum of colors.
Interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing that, Joanne. I want to ask you, totally off subject here, but I want to ask you, because I was reading your blog, you just got back from a trip to Lapland with your daughter Anushka.
Yes, that's right.
You went dog sledding and crab fishing. Tell us about that.
It was fabulous. Yes, we went up to Kirkenes. I've been writing a piece about extreme tourism for an English newspaper. So, yes, I do one of these occasionally, once or twice. And it was rather nice to go there because it's extremely cold. And because I'm now writing the sequel to Rune Marks, it was kind of nice to go up slightly north of the Arctic Circle there and go back to that sort of rather cold and harsh and primitive world.
And I say you entitled this, The Everyday Touring Life of a Jobbing Writer. That's somewhat out of everyday going to Lapland there.
Well, I've come to the conclusion as I've been touring over the past few years that there is no everyday and that absolutely anything can happen. And this is one of the wonderful things, that, you know, nothing is ever entirely routine anymore, because you just don't know. One day you will be doing something sublime, and the next day you'll be sitting in a shed addressing two people and a small dog, and the next day you'll be shaking hands with movie stars. And, you know, you never quite know what's around the corner, and it makes for a very interesting life.
Sure. On Friday, just last Friday on your blog, you wrote, if I hear the words, how do you spell it, or I think we've sold out of books again, I'm going to kill myself. I hope you're having a better week this week.
I'm having a great week. I mean, the interesting thing about touring the States is that you can't take anything for granted. So some days you turn up to an absolutely packed room, and then another day there's basically nobody there. Now, this is quite anxiety provoking from one point of view, but also it takes me back to what it used to be like when I was starting off. And I think the nice thing of dealing with the unexpected in this way is that it's constantly testing you, and you have to prove to yourself that you can still hack it, which is great. It means that you're always a bit more grounded, and you never quite take things for granted. But no, it's been great this time, and I've had a fabulous lot of kids today at the Walden School, and they all bought the books, and they were just hugely enthusiastic, and they're all out there now in the corridor casting runes at each other, which is hysterical.
Well, that's good. That's good. And I want to just remind listeners that you're going to be up here in Bellingham on January 18th, which I think is Friday. Is that Friday?
Probably.
Yeah, 1 o'clock at Village Books in Bellingham. Yes, Eric's giving me the thumb up. That's Friday. And you're also going to be in Seattle at Third Place Books on January 18th at 6:30 p.m. Now, are you doing a signing there or a reading, or do you kind of go with the flow depending on?
Well, normally I do a reading, a talk, a signing, some Q&A.
Very good.
And, you know, I mean, it's all pretty flexible, actually.
Mm. So what are you working on now? I know I read somewhere that you're learning Old Norse.
Yes, I have been. I've been trying to learn Old Icelandic, because there are so many of these runic texts that haven't been properly translated since, you know, the 12th century or something. And it's kind of nice to read certain things in the original, because however many translations you read, a lot is still lost. And besides, it's a very interesting language to learn. I'm doing it kind of slowly by correspondence course, because I'm very lazy.
I'm sure it's quite difficult, though. Isn't it difficult?
It's not too bad. Because I did Middle High German when I was at university, as well as Modern German, I've got a starting point.
Oh, okay.
So it's not too terribly bad. And because I've got a kind of smattering of other languages as well, it means that I'm not starting completely from scratch. And it is very rewarding.
Well, I look forward to seeing your new book, Joanne. We're at the end of our show right now. And Rune Marks is a great book. I really thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, thank you.
Look forward to seeing The Girl with No Shadow when that comes out.
I look forward to being back.
And your website are www.joannharris.co.uk, is that correct?
That's right, joann-harris.co.uk. Or you can just Google me and I'll pop right up.
Yep, or the Rune Marks book and she'll pop right up again too. Thanks so much, Joanne.
Thank you very much indeed.
And you can reach me at conversationslive.net. You can also listen to podcasts of featured shows and or call me toll-free at 1-800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. Please stay tuned to find out who I'm talking with next Monday at noon. Meanwhile, live well, live strong, and thank you for spending this hour with me on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Join Vicky St. Clair and MSNBC's Bob Sullivan to learn how to save money and avoid the everyday hidden fees applied by big business. Tune in Monday, January 21st at noon for Gotcha Capitalism on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. For more information, see conversationslive.net.
Views expressed.